This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. I'm Mark Stephen.
And I'm Ewan McIlraith. And this week I've been visiting some seahorse babies and exploring the mysteries of the shipping forecast.
For donkey's years, we've been going to a place called Orgatti, which is actually not famous for donkeys, but for red kites. But they've got another species in there now, squirrels, and absolutely hit lucky with them. Fantastic. I also had a very interesting chat with a woman who's taken over as chief executive of Scottish Natural Heritage, Francesca Sofska. She's in the midst at the moment of actually touring all the national nature reserves in Scotland in rather a novel way. I met up with her at Forvey Nature Reserve near Aberdeen.
So at the moment, I'm on what we're calling Cycle for Nature, and this is me as a relatively new chief executive wanting to visit all of SNH's 37 offices. And as a keen cyclist, I decided to do it by bike as a way of raising the profile of SNH and hopefully tapping into some other agendas such as active travel.
To say you're a keen cyclist is something of an understatement. I mean, you're a bit of a fitness nut.
They're your words, not mine.
You've done four Ironmans, for goodness sake.
I've dabbled in triathlon. Certainly moving a bit more to cycling at the moment. And this year, I'm spending a reasonable amount of time on my bike.
Yeah. Just to explain, we're actually sitting on the flight path, and it's a crew change day on the oil rigs today. We're sitting on Forvey Nature Reserve. This is one of the reserves you come to visit by bicycle. What's the advantage of actually doing it by bike rather than doing it by car?
For me, as a cyclist, if I can do something on two wheels, I will. There's some other advantages as well. I think the first point is that I'm encouraging staff, if they want, and it's certainly not compulsory, to cycle with me on parts of the route. And that's had really good take up. And so most of the route I've been accompanied by local staff, and they're able to point out to me areas of interest, projects that they're working on, areas that are designated, and hearing from them as we travel and actually at a slower pace than you would do by car has really added to the richness of the experience. I think the other thing is making it into almost a project and a thing has actually made it happen in a way which I think if I'd said at the beginning of the year, right, I'm going to all offices, sometimes the diary just gets too difficult. Whereas doing it like this, the dates have been cemented in the diary and it's going to happen, which is great.
I suppose another aspect, and I'm not being funny here, is that if you say to staff, I, as your chief executive, am coming to visit you, I mean, that's kind of, it's like a visitation. Very difficult to be intimidated by somebody standing there in cycling shorts.
Yeah, and there have been times when I've gone into offices and, had conversations with colleagues and I'm, standing there a bit sort of dishevelled, where I've thought, that's an interesting impression. But actually, what's been great is every office that I visit, I want to take time to have discussions with colleagues, hear from them about their aspirations for SNH and hear from them directly about some of the challenges, and being able to do that in a relaxed way is great. And if that means me sitting there a bit smelly and dishevelled, then that's fine by me.
What have you actually found on the trip so far? I mean, give me your impressions.
The overriding impression is the commitment of all our staff to their roles, whether it's our NNR staff, who I think just do a fantastic job in terms of their engagement, their community outreach, working with different members of the community, be it visitors to the reserves, school groups, etc., or our staff in offices working again with local authorities and a range of partners to ensure that we are able to connect people and nature, and that we're able to ensure that people enjoy our fantastic natural assets, but they're here for years to come. So that commitment really shines through in the passion. And we've got this incredible range of knowledge, experience, which we use within the organisation in terms of the provision of our advice and dealing with some quite challenging issues. So that range has been really great for me to see.
What do you think attracts those people particularly to come and work for SNH? Organisation or the country?
I think it's a bit of both, and I think it's actually a passion for the subject matter, which either they've studied in you know, a lot of cases, the majority of cases, or they have become interested in the subject and then studied alongside work in some cases. SNH is a fantastic workplace for that passion to be maintained and to be able to contribute to, you know, one of our wider goals in exposing and promoting in a sustainable way all of our natural assets, whether that's our biodiversity, our geology, our, you know, fantastic habitats and species to a wider population in Scotland.
Coming back to your cycle trip, of all the things you've seen so far, I mean, what's the sort of one image, the one shining day or afternoon or whatever that's kind of going to come back to you?
So if I say it's all been great, then that kind of, you know, that's sort of, you know.
You're going to have to pick on this one.
I have to pick,
sorry,
I have to pick. No, but I mean, genuinely, the one kind of, I suppose, if you were to say what's been that standout moment, I cycled from the southern tip of Harris up to Keogh's Harbour, just outside Stornoway in April. And it was just a stunning day. It's stunning scenery. We got to Keogh's and I went on a boat trip with a local wildlife tourism provider. And, you know, part of the reason for that particular visit was to, you know, talk about wildlife tourism, what the impact of the mink eradication project, which SNH has supported, has been. And, you know, A, obviously the scenery was amazing, but B, again, seeing, I suppose, some of the reach of our work, which you might not expect, you know, in terms of that tourism provider and how to, you know, wildlife tourism is becoming a really important part of, you know, many economies. That really was a great day.
Francesca Sofska, Chief Executive of Scottish Natural Heritage, and we'll have more from her coming up shortly.
It's an awful way to visit all your domain, but it's my idea of hell. The head of the BBC arrives on a bike and he's fit as anything, is he? Right, let's go around Scotland.
Follow me. No. And it would be follow. Well, the operations manager for the Aberdeen office picked up Francesca from the train station in Montrose. He had his bike, she had her bike. They then cycled about 20 miles north to St Cyrus, and actually went to visit that, and then cycled from the sea level right up over the Caernarfon down towards Bankry. I wouldn't do it in a moped.
This is why we are never going to get the job as Chief Executive of Scottish Natural Heritage.
We're just not trying hard enough. Seahorses are delightful wee beasties. These armour-plated pseudo-equines of the marine world, just put a smile on your face.
Yeah, they're simple organisms, and because of that simplicity, they're really difficult to get to breed successfully in captivity. That is until now, because the staff at the Macduff Aquarium have pulled off a bit of an aquatic coup. Marine biologist Chris Rowe.
Seahorse is a fish. It's a member of the Cygnaphidae family, which basically classify seahorses and pipefish.
And you've got one here. It's a lot bigger than I expected. I thought they were about an inch high, but that's, what, 3.5, 4 inches long?
Yeah, it's not an unusual size for an adult male seahorse. It's not going to get any bigger than that. It'll be about that kind of size now for the rest of his life. Females sometimes are fractionally larger, but he's the one with the brood pouch, so he's the important one.
And they're really strange-looking beasts when you get close up. I mean, they are real dinosaur look.
They are really cool. They will vary quite a lot. There's a lot of tropical species that are even more spiny and frilly than he is. He's a spiny seahorse, so he's got a lot of kind of protrusions on his head and spines, for want of a better word.
And are they relatively common in British water?
Not really. Certainly down south, you're looking at kind of Cornwall, Devon, neck of the woods, you will find them in reasonable numbers, but I wouldn't say they're an abundant species.
So they are possible you get them in Scottish waters?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about the kind of the gates? Because fish, you tend to think, are going along sideways. They go along vertically, and I suppose that would give them that real character.
They absolutely have a character. They're completely different to your normal swimming fish. They will sit vertical in the water and swim around. They do tend to spend a lot of time with their prehensile tail wrapped around a bit of weed or twigs or anything like that they find in the water. And they're just there sitting, waiting for food to drift past them.
So this one you've got in the tank at the moment, it's upright. It's got its tail curled around a bit of vegetation. It's just waiting for something to come past.
Yeah, he's waiting for food. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. He's probably just about waiting for his second food of the day. And yeah, he's a planktonic feeder, so he's waiting on little shrimps whizzing past his nose. He doesn't hunt down bits of food like you kind of expect other fish to do. So he's just waiting on the food flowing past him.
So he's pretty slow then?
Yeah, they are quite slow. And they tend to like a little bit of water movement, a little bit of kind of water streaming past them. But yeah, they're generally quite slow animals.
And the shrimps that you're feeding them with, what are they?
The adults get mysid shrimps, which are shrimps about a centimetre long, and they're all frozen, so we've got the adults on dead frozen food. The little juveniles, babies we've got, are on fresh live hatched brine.
They're quite difficult to feed. You've got to feed them all the time.
You do, absolutely. Seahorses don't have stomachs, so they've only got one long tube that they do all their digestion through, and the food basically goes in one end and comes out the other. So yeah, you've got to keep a regular supply of food within them.
So that must be difficult to survive.
Yeah, it is a wonder sometimes how they survive in the wild. I presume they just live in areas where the shrimps are in abundance and they've constantly got a supply of food. They've been around for millions of years, so I assume they're doing something right.
Now, this one's on its own in a tank. Why is that?
We reckon he's pregnant again. So we're now quarantining him, for want of a better word.
Just, he's pregnant?
He's pregnant, absolutely. It's the male that gives birth. There's very few animals out there where it's the male that gives birth, but seahorses are one of them. So he's the one with the brood pouch. The female passes the eggs onto him, and yeah, it's up to him to do the work.
And the babies come out live?
Yeah, the babies come out live. They're about 4 mil, 5 mil or so when they're born. The last batch we had 214.
And they're quite difficult to get to breed. This is a success story for you.
We're delighted here. It's the first time we've ever had breeding seahorses, but we're just now facing quite a difficult task in keeping these little babies alive.
Because they've got them in a circular tank, and they are three quarters of an inch long, a really strange tail as well.
Yeah, they're pretty much a fully grown seahorse. There's no difference between the babies and the adults. So they've got that tail for clinging onto any bits of weed they come across. It doesn't tend to happen until they're about 6 weeks old that they'll need to find what we call holdfast to cling onto. So they're quite happy swimming around in the plankton. In the wild, the male seahorse would produce something in the region of 2,000-odd babies, and they would all swim off into the plankton and just get washed around in the sea. So at the moment, they're quite happy in a tank on their own like that.
So how old are these ones?
These are now 30 to 31 days old.
How do they move? I'm trying, because there's kind of don't seem any visible means of propulsion.
You have to look really closely here. They've got a little fin just at the back, tends to do most of the work. And then they've got a couple of other fins up just behind their gills, behind their eyes, that allow them to move left and right. They're very strange animals.
Are they out in an evolutionary limb, or are there other things that kind of have that vertical gait?
I think it's only really seahorses and sea dragons that tend to do that vertical gait. Even their close relatives, pikefish, swim very normally in the water, although pikefish will sit vertical in the weed.
So what predators have they got? I mean, obviously they're not here.
Oh, nothing in here, hopefully. No one with fishing rods. In the wild, certainly as planktonic babies, pretty much anything would get hold of them, which is why only one in every 2,000 would generally survive in the wild. As adults, they're pretty well camouflaged, so it would take a fairly...
spiny as well, aren't they?
Fish. Yeah, I can't imagine they're very good eating. They're a bit spiny and bony.
So what happens to these babies now?
We're going to look after them here and try our best to keep the 9 that we've got alive so far going. They are very difficult to keep going at this age, simply for the fact that they have a very delicate gut, so the food that we feed them has to be very fresh, otherwise it tends to cause some problems.
Presumably you don't want to put them in a big tank.
Not just yet, no. There's the tank set up for the adults. It's not going to do the baby so well. So we'll keep them in our quarantine area until they're probably about 2 inches or so in length, possibly somewhere in the region of 5 to 6 months. And then, fingers crossed, if they're all alive then, they can go and mix with the adults.
And when's this one due? Or don't you know?
Oh, we don't know. It's kind of difficult to tell. I had reports about a week ago that he was starting to get fat, so I would predict probably 10 days to 2 weeks if he's pregnant at all. He might have just eaten too many shrimps.
Chris Rowe of Macduff Aquarium.
Beautiful, he thinks.
Yeah.
And much bigger than I thought. I thought they were only about an inch high, but they're actually about kind of 3.5, 4 inches high.
I think they come in various sizes.
Yeah.
Because I've seen them in tropical marine aquariums, you know, and sometimes they can be quite large, sometimes they can be absolutely tiny. Sometimes they have these sort of fantastic, almost like fronds of seaweed coming off them too, but really brightly multicoloured. Beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous wee things. I mean, I didn't realise we had them around British waters, I must admit.
Oh, no, there you go. We made the mistake of mentioning on the live programme Aquaman, which neither of us could remember tremendously well, other than the fact that we thought he probably rode a seahorse, which indeed he does.
Which he called Storm.
Storm.
And he had a sidekick called Aqualad, whose name was Garth.
Yeah, and I can't remember what his horse was
called. His horse was called Sea Imp.
Sea Imp, yeah.
Yes.
Or Simp, for short.
It was one of those strange superheroes that you never actually worked out what they did.
Registered.
They did it with great power and confidence.
He had the ability to command the creatures of the sea.
Yes.
That much I remember. We've been paying visits to Argati Farm near Doon ever since they established themselves as a feeding station for red kites back in 1996. Now, the red kites have become a very popular feature, but now there's another attraction down on the farm, a woodland hide. Tom Bowser was very keen to show me.
Is this thing electric?
It is, yeah, an electric buggy.
It's absolutely silent other than the roof, which is obviously homemade and very, very rattly.
Yes, my father won't be too pleased with you for the obviously homemade comment, but not so good for sneaking up quietly on the sheep.
Yeah. That's the sound of us bouncing through 3-foot-high thistles.
I hadn't actually realised they'd taken down the fence here, so we're going to make it all the way across, which is nice.
Given the fact that you are surrounded by trees, they are big trees, they are mature trees, just when it comes to having red kite habitat, you kind of want to watch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we had no idea, really, that, you know, we were such a good spot for the kites. You know, I mean, down here we've got a lot of old broadleaf trees, but we found the majority of our nests over the years have been in the conifer woods around here, you know, which is interesting. You know, you'd think these big trees with the massive branches and everything would be an ideal spot, but no, it's turned out for us, you know, conifer trees, the big conifer trees seem to be the ones that they go for here. And, you know, the kites, you know, are so reliant on us for food. They'll always kind of, you know, stay, I guess, quite close to, you know, where they think there might be a chance of some kind of roadkill or food supplies.
They're not daft.
No.
Where's the hide from here?
So the hide here, we're going to cut through this fallen bit of fence in here.
Okay.
Just watch your feet when you're going through, because the sheep and the lambs came in here on some of the colder days, and there's quite a lot of mess in there that you could stand in if you'd like to.
Won't bother me in the slightest. Now the hide itself is basically just a lapboard wooden shed in the middle of this little copse of trees. And if we go in quietly, lovely smell of fresh cut timber too.
Yeah, we just went and discovered the squirrels down here. And for about close to a year I've been looking for somewhere we could set up a hide to watch them, and found this spot, you know, where they were running about here just earlier on this year, and thought, yeah, this is it, you know, a nice open space, be good for the photographers, there's clearly squirrels here. So initially my plan had been to build a hide myself, but my dad had pointed out that if I tried to do that, I'd make a mess of it and it would take a whole year to build it, so I've had it made by a local shed making company. The squirrels tend to come from over on our right here. You see there's quite a lot of fallen trees over at the side here, and then they'll come running in through the fence here and up to one of our feed boxes. So we've got
one feed box on the tree there, you can see, and then I've actually hidden another one behind this cut-off stump here. We wanted to get photographers a chance to have the squirrels, you know, feeding in a kind of natural setting, and you know, if they were just going to the boxes here, then you know, it was very much a kind of man-made photograph people were getting. So yeah, I've put in a mini box on the back of the stump here, and they kind of come into there, and yeah, the box is completely invisible from the hide here, but it'll hopefully get people the shot that they're looking for. It's a bit of an experiment.
This is interesting though, because I mean, for a long time, must be nearly 20 years now, I associate the word agate with red kites. Presumably the squirrels have been here for a while.
Actually, you know, this is the funny thing. So in 18 years growing up here, before I went away to university, I saw two red squirrels. So it's completely changed. I mean, the other day, my daughter and I, we were sitting having breakfast, and we had four squirrels in the garden there, four reds. And what's happened, we had a really great head ranger here for a number of years who did a lot of work on red squirrel conservation and managed to really boost the numbers of reds here. You know, we were once, like a lot of places around here, grey squirrel only. Been involved in the Saving Scotland's Red Squirrels feeder box surveys, where you put up these flip-top boxes with double-sided tape inside the lid, and a squirrel goes in and leaves some fur on there, and you can tell from a test then, or by even just by looking at it.
Be honest, can you? Because somebody showed me that box and they said, look, there's a red and there's a grey, and I'm looking at the hairs thinking, looks exactly the same to me. I couldn't tell a colour difference in that.
Oh yeah, well, I'm an expert. Yeah. Don't have a clue either. Other estates around here are doing the same thing.
Because obviously, you know, it's not just a case of knowing that you've got greys. You then have to eradicate the greys. You have to have a policy of trapping and killing.
Yeah, which is, you know, I think for anyone that kind of likes wildlife, the idea of any kind of culling is pretty unpalatable. You know, until they can find out some means of some kind of sterilisation drug that will work, I think there's no real option, it seems.
You see anything?
Not yet, no. I'll open up the shutters here. I'm just seeing. What we'll probably find, it seems to be a bit of a pattern in that when you first come down here, you have a kind of 20-minute lull. And usually you'll find that the birds come in first, and then after that, the reds, it's almost like they take a cue from them, and they'll start coming in. Obviously, with it being the middle of the day, it might kind of skew things a wee bit. Normally, when we're renting out the hide, we're doing it from kind of early morning until lunchtime, and then afternoon sessions, you know, just to try and avoid like this
being... Siesta period.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's also new to us, all this. You know, we've got stealth cameras out here, and we're trying to establish patterns, you know, with the kites, because we've been doing that for 22 years. You kind of know most of what's going on, and if the kites aren't coming down for the food, then you can at least work up some kind of decent theory of why that might be. But with the squirrels, it's a whole new world. You know? It's a lot to pick up on them.
Tom Bowser, and you can find out later how our squirrel spotting actually went.
You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Keep the emails and the messages coming in. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and that address again is outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
For the past 17 years, there's been a major project to eradicate mink from Lewis and Harris. It's been the largest scheme of its kind in the world, and it looks like it's producing very positive results, as Helen Needham discovered when she spoke to David McLennan, area manager for the Outer Hebrides and Argyll for Scottish Natural Heritage.
Well, this is the River Creed, a small salmon river that runs into Stornoway Harbour. It's a good example of a watercourse in Lewis and Harris that would have been inhabited by mink. And it's one of the catchments that we've been working on with the local angling club in particular here, getting mink out of the catchment.
And why have you wanted to get mink out of the catchment?
Well, it's not just this catchment. The work we've been doing has been getting mink out of the whole of the Outer Hebrides. We've been thinking about the whole of the area and the effort that we need to put in to remove them from everywhere. Because if you don't remove them from everywhere, they just move around and they come back in. So the approach that we had to take was to look at it at the population level rather than individual catchments.
And what's so bad about mink?
Mink are an invasive non-native species. They're not resident in the United Kingdom. They were released here accidentally or deliberately, we don't know, from fur farms that were throughout the country, actually, during the 1950s and the 1960s. The habitat here is perfect for them. We've got such an extensive coastline, we've got so many rivers, so many lochs, that they absolutely thrived in the environment here. And the problem with mink being non-native is by introducing them into the environment, they've taken on a niche that didn't exist, that we don't have ground predators in the islands. And they've started predating on species of birds, of fish, that have been here for thousands of years in the absence of ground predators. So what we saw happening very quickly was that populations of birds were going down to the point of disappearing. And this was because of predation by mink that they simply could not cope with.
What kind of birds are you talking about?
The most obvious ones were birds that nest in colonies. So things like Arctic terns, common terns. Mink would go into a tern colony and overnight they would literally wipe out a tern colony. One day you would have adults, you would have young, the next day you would go in and there was nothing. Because the behaviour that mink exhibit from the wild from North America is they kill more than they need to eat.
So it's for sport, really?
It's not for sport. It's a perfectly natural behaviour. Where they come from in North America and Canada, there's very limited food available. And what they tend to do when they come across a food supply, they will kill as much as they possibly can, because that's what will then keep them alive for the next, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months.
So their instinct is to hoard them?
They, absolutely. That's exactly what they do. Unfortunately, when that behaviour takes place in an environment that can't cope with that, we get problems because they would kill too much to eat. And then because it's not cold here like the areas where they live, So whatever they kill and stash just quickly rots and disappears. So they've got to keep doing it. And that's what's been happening. And that's why we saw such spectacular declines here.
How did you go about trying to control the mink numbers, say on a river like this?
We've had to think about this, about the whole island. Lewis and Harris, the Outer Hebrides, is a big place. It's about 3,000 square kilometres, a huge area of ground to cover. But mink depend on water. So that narrows it down a bit. So we can target the coastal areas, we can target the rivers, we can target the lochs by being very, very careful about where we sited traps along the coasts, the rivers, the lochs. We managed to put a network of traps in place that covered literally the whole island. So 7,500 mink traps in Lewis and Harris alone. And these traps would be checked regularly every day because they were live traps that we were using initially to see if there was anything there. And there was literally one mink trap every 500 metres along every stretch of coast, every river and every loch. It's a huge undertaking.
Were you finding mink regularly?
Very much so. The total number of mink that we've caught to date, it's over 2,000, 2,198 to be precise.
Over what sort of time period?
That's over a 17-year period.
Goodness.
So, I mean, obviously, when you're doing work of this nature, you catch more at the beginning.
Yeah.
Our aim here is to catch nothing.
Have you reached that point yet?
We're doing now. We're not catching anything now.
Okay.
That's not to say that there's none, that there's still nothing out there. We can't be 100% certain that there's nothing left. But what we can do is carry on. We do have traps in place. We do still have people employed. We are still monitoring what's out there. But the results that we're seeing now are really, really promising. We have not caught a young mink in Lewis and Harris in the last 3 years, which is telling us there's no mink breeding in Lewis and Harris, which is very, very encouraging.
Have you noticed any positive impact on, say, some of these vulnerable bird populations or the fish populations in the last few years?
Very much so. This year, there's a survey taking place of terns throughout the Outer Hebrides. We're seeing tern colonies re-establishing themselves in places throughout the Outer Hebrides where they've disappeared over the course of the last 20 to 30 years because mink have been predating on them. The fact that we're seeing that this year and we're seeing young terns being produced from these colonies is a hugely positive response to the work that we've been doing in removing mink from the Outer Hebrides.
Well, I can vouch for the fact that there are terns around
good.
Because I was on Harris and I was basically shooed away from a beach
Good.
By some terns.
Did you enjoy that?
Well, I've had a bad experience with a tern before on the island of Hoy.
Right.
But luckily my colleague Mark Stephen was there and he took the hit.
Okay.
But I was on my own this time, so I thought, I'm not risking it being attacked. But there they were.
Well, again, that's their defence mechanism. They're just trying to protect their young. They're just giving you a little warning to keep away.
Yes.
So it's great that they're back.
Ellen Needham there. I was actually, as she said, with her.
You rescued her?
Well, not really rescued her, because she kind of dived for the ground and was shouting, tell it to go away. And I said, I don't think it's going to listen.
Oh, see, so she left you to it.
Yeah, exactly. She said, I took the hit for her. Well, it did rhyme, and it went straight in my eye. I have to say, it stings a bit, that.
Oh, see, it wasn't the beak.
It wasn't the beak. It was the other end.
Oh.
The other end. Yeah. But no, she thought that was very funny, whereas I thought her diving to the ground was very funny. The tern wasn't amused either way.
Anyway, potentially a very good story. If they ever manage to eradicate the mink, it's fantastic. The wildlife will recover. The only danger is, as they hinted there, you have to keep really on top of it. One pregnant female missed, and within 5 years, you're back at the same problem.
Yeah, pretty well. Let's stick with Scottish Natural Heritage now and go back to my chat with Francesca Osowska, new chief executive of the organisation. I met up with her at Forvey Sands, just one of the legs on a cycle trip round all SNH offices and reserves. Francesca's been in post since October, so the obvious thing to do was to say, right, in your opinion, what is the point of Scottish Natural Heritage? What's it for?
I see our role as contributing to, you know, a wide range of Scottish Government economic and social objectives. We cannot ignore the fact that we have an overriding government purpose to promote sustainable economic growth. And I think where we come in is that emphasis on the sustainable, and our new corporate plan, Connecting People and Nature, I think is a realisation that we can't have nature in a box and in a vacuum. People interact with nature either for productive means, either, you know, for economic benefit or for enjoyment. And we've got a role to ensure that that happens in a, you know, in a sustainable way, and that these natural assets are here for many generations to come.
And when did that happen, though? When did it become sustainable economic development?
I think that's been, you know, something that has been promoted by, you know, governments for, you know, if you take kind of the evolution of the National Performance Framework in Scotland, I mean, that's been at its centre point. And I think as a, you know, as a framework which pulls all public bodies in Scotland together, it's been really helpful. And every, you know, public body and has it its own particular remit and role there. I think you mentioned the sort of tricky issues, and we do get involved in some difficult issues, and we are the public body that is going to stand up for nature, and at times we have to give that advice, and that can be difficult. We have to do it in a way which recognises the political landscape, and I think we are able to do that. But up until, you know, I talk about red lines, and other people might use different expressions, but up until a point at which we think that our habitats and species are going to be severely compromised and we are going to give that advice, then we've got a really strong role in, I think, facilitating discussions between different interest groups by trying to find a way forward, by adding value to different proposals. And that's a really skilled role for a lot of staff in SNH to be able to engage in that way.
It is, and I wouldn't take away from that. But do you never find yourself sitting there thinking, I wish we could do more than this? Rather than just offering advice, rather than facilitating, actually say, no, this will not happen. Here is a red line. Mm-hmm. You cannot cross it.
Well, and we do. We object to planning.
That's very often overturned, and you know
sometimes, yes, sometimes that is overturned. That is the system in which we operate. Do I ever sit there and think, could things be different? My job is to make sure that we're doing the maximum we can with the powers and the resources that we have. And I think we do that incredibly well. I would say that, wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I genuinely believe that. I think we've managed quite a tricky period in terms of budget resourcing very well. And we have a lot of credibility in communities for being able yet to, you know, at times provide that strong advice, but also engage in a more facilitative way, and that's what we have to do.
This well predates you adopting the role, but take 4 or 5 miles down the coast there, you know, the mini golf course. SNH actually recommended that not go forward. Mm-hmm. Now, that was overturned. You know, here we are however many years down the line, and SNH find themselves in the invidious position of saying, yes, it has damaged the environment. It must be really frustrating.
And our review of SSSI's, I'm sure all of your listeners know, Sites of Special Scientific Interest, is ongoing, and there'll be a paper for the board on that later this year. And as you've recognised, we've released information on that particular SSSI in response to a Freedom of Information request. That's the evidence we have, and you know, we're under a duty to review the state of our SSSIs. For me, and it's not just because that particular case predates me, I think this is more to do with, you know, the personality I am. Am I frustrated about that? No, because you deal with the facts here and now. I can't rewind that clock. We deal with that kind of issue. We'll be looking at the review of SSSIs in the future, and we go forward. We learn from different experiences and build that into processes in the future.
You can learn from those experiences and change the processes, but will that necessarily stop it happening again? And I'm thinking of Cool Links, mm-hmm. you know, which is the obvious example. Again, the recommendation was probably no, and then the local council have turned around and said yes, probably yes, because they're looking at the economic side of this, and mm-hmm. I can well understand that. Mm-hmm. But an awful lot of people listening to this are going to be thinking, surely, if there is a scientific designation on it, that should confer almost automatic protection, but it doesn't.
No, and we've given our advice on Cool Links, and as you know, we've objected in relation to the sand dune aspect of that proposal. As you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, that's subject now to a potential Scottish Government calling in, so probably not more than I can say at the moment. Again, that is the system in which we operate. We provide the best and most evidence-based advice that we can. We, you know, we live in a democracy, and other people take decisions, and that's how it is.
Francesca Osowska, the Scottish Natural Heritage, and she hopes to have a cycle ride finished by October.
I got the impression she was perhaps choosing her words very carefully, mm-hmm. and there was an element, I may be wrong here, of not what was being said, but what was between the lines.
SNH has always been an advisory body, but that phrase that she used, you know, to assist in sustainable economic development, obviously they're concentrating on the sustainable part of it, but I could be wrong in this, entirely wrong in this. That seemed to me to be a shift in emphasis from what SNH was about, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Protecting our natural heritage as opposed to economic development. We'll keep an eye on it, but if you've got thoughts on that, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Many years ago, when I was a boy broadcaster, I used to sit in a tiny wee cubicle in the dark, and coming up to midnight, and we'd put a particular piece of music on. It's not a national treasure, but what it is, it's one of those iconic moments of British broadcasting. And really, that episode, that experience, night after night after night, is down to the sheer perseverance of just one naval officer.
Yeah, we're talking about the shipping forecast. Now, for regular fans of the Radio 4 forecast, this music could be all too familiar. But if you're new to this piece of radio, no matter where you are in the world, enjoy. For many in this country, the weather is an obsession. And for true die-hard weather fans, there's nothing better than winding down by the radio as the gentle strains of sailing by ease you into the National Institution
that is the sailing forecast.
This is BBC Radio 4. Now, here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 26th of July. There are warnings of gales in Rockhall, Bailey, Faroes, and southeast Iceland.
For some, it's an idle interest into the coming weather patterns, but for those at sea, it can be a lifesaver. With a gale on the horizon, it's time to head for port. There are 31 sea areas around Britain. Some are named after sandbanks.
Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s. Variable, mainly becoming southeasterly, 3 or 4. Occasionally 5 in Viking and 40s. Fair, good, occasionally poor.
Some are estuaries.
Cromarty, 4th, Tyne. South or southeast 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Thundery showers later, good, occasionally poor later.
Two are named after towns.
Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth. Variable 3 or 4, becoming easterly 5 later in East Dover. Mainly fair, moderate or good.
And one, the most northerly point of Ireland, Malin Head. There's also the Bay of Biscay and Cape Trafalgar. But there's only one sea area named after a person.
Fitzroy. Variable 4 at first in east, otherwise southerly or southwesterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 at first in north. Occasional rain, good, occasionally poor.
In fact, prior to 2002, Fitzroy didn't exist at all. It was called Finisterre. But the French and the Spanish also have their own sea forecast, and they have a bit of sea they call Finisterre, Spanish Finisterra, end of the earth. But unfortunately, it was in a different bit of sea to the British version. So the French and Spanish went hand in hand to the international authorities, who ordered Britain to change the name. So after 53 years, Finisterre was no more heard on the airways of the BBC and replaced by Fitzroy. But who was Fitzroy, and why was he given this very special honour? Well, Captain Robert Fitzroy first rose to fame as a very young naval officer in the post-Waterloo Royal Navy. His star was shining, and when he was appointed to skipper HMS Beagle and take a young Charles Darwin round the world, you would have thought he had it made. But Fitzroy had two defining traits. One was a deep depression, which would see him with fits of anger and despondency. He just wasn't an easy man to be with. And the other was an obsession with the weather. At that time, ship's masters would carry frogs in a glass case with a small ramp, with the premise that an approaching gale would send the frogs down the slope or up to predict benign weather. The result, an estimated 1,000 ships were lost at sea every year due to gales. But one incident grabbed the attention of the nation, and Captain Fitzroy in particular. On Tuesday, the 25th of October, 1859, the Royal Charter steam clipper, 59 days out of Melbourne, carrying £300,000 worth of gold bullion and 400 passengers, ignored the obvious signs of a gale which was approaching, but pressed on, trying to make Liverpool. They never made it. The storm struck, anchors were thrown overboard, but the Royal Charter ended up on the rocks of Anglesey. Only 41 men made it ashore. All the women and all the children perished. In 1859, Robert Fitzroy was 54 years old, by then an admiral. A couple of years early, he had founded the Met Office, which is basically a place to store charts. But appalled by the loss of life, Fitzroy decided something had to be done. By making use of the newly established telegraph, he received reports from ports all round the coast every morning. He collated the data, analysed it, and if a storm was brewing, he telegraphed a specific storm warning to that port, which raised a warning drum high above the town to warn ships to return to safety. His first storm warning was sent in February 1861, cautioning a gale off the northeast coast. It was a huge success among sailors, but earned him some very powerful enemies. The shipowners detested the new weather forecast, as skippers would refuse to sail if a gale was forecast. If they wanted sea, they weren't making money. Ships could be insured and losses compensated, but a ship tied up in harbour were losing cash. The owners wanted the forecast banned. Despite the success of his quest, Fitzroy still suffered ever-worsening bouts of deep depression. And then, on the 30th of April 1865, at the age of 59, he took his own life. His critics seized the opportunity. Without a champion for the forecast, the ship owners lobbied Parliament, and within a year, the weather forecast service was withdrawn. The shipping magnates had won. But the Met Office prevailed, and by the end of the decade, the forecast was reinstated. Finisterre was renamed Fitzroy, in honour of the father of weather forecasting, in 2002.
And that completes the shipping bulletin.
The shipping forecast and Admiral Robert Fitzroy.
I just love delving into that, the fact that people tried to get it banned.
Yeah, oh, great. I was doing it one night, and you come up and it's absolutely has to run on rails. You have a set amount of words.
380 words.
Something like that. And you've got a set period of time to do it in, and it has to happen at that point. I mean, there's no equivocation. That's the way you do it. And just when I started to read it, good evening, there, for shipping forecast, my nose started to bleed. And I had to do the entire forecast two time with basically... What a mess.
It's not funny.
It's not funny, but it was funny, actually. The security guys thought it was hilarious.
The south of it's either covered in blood.
Yeah, well, it happens. Let's go back to Agatti Farm near Doon. Many of you will know it is a red kite centre, but nowadays the farm's got a big enough population of red squirrels to have also invested in a woodland hide. Tom Bowser and I were poised.
And despite predictions to the contrary, we've got a squirrel. It's quite a dark squirrel too.
Yeah, really interesting. When I first started up the hide here, we just had the hide built, and that day I saw this really dark squirrel and I had a heart attack. I thought, oh no, it's a grey squirrel. But actually, then saw the wee tufts and realised it was a bit smaller and that it was a red. But yeah, we seem to have a real variety here. You know, we've got some that are kind of iron brew orange, and then we've got some that really are very dark. Interesting that just came and took the food and away again. You know, that seems to be a bit of a thing in the middle of the day as well. I don't know if it's probably not so much the heat, but maybe just the fact that it's a bit more visible to predators that come in and sometimes get the food and go away.
There's a cock pheasant just coming the other side of the fence.
Yeah, these guys are pretty cheeky. You have to put out kind of half as much food again when they're about... we've got two of them that are kind of battling for supremacy here. One of them's got a gammy leg, but seems to be the winner most of the time.
But you watch that squirrel, and it, as you say, gets the food. I mean, it's absolutely noiseless, just bam, 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 bang. And it's so gymnastic, it's so athletic an animal.
Yeah, it's interesting. The only times, occasionally if it's very still here, you'll hear them scampering down from the canopy. But a lot of the time you wouldn't even know they were there. In fact, I mean, I had never heard a squirrel make any kind of noise until one time I came in to fill up the feeders and didn't realise that a squirrel was in one of the boxes, and it came shooting out, went away up the tree, and they kind of make this weird gobbling sound, kind of like an angry hen.
Yeah, basically they scold you.
Yeah, absolutely. This thing that I'd been feeding for weeks on end was sitting up on the branch telling me where to go, basically. Hi.
Sorry, just slightly distracted. There's a nuthatch just straight in the tree in front of it. It's on the left-hand side of the tree, facing downwards. That black eye stripe, beautiful wee bird.
Yeah, we wouldn't have seen nuthatches here until about 4 years ago. Oh. Again, started getting them in my garden. And now we see them all the time. And, these wee guys, I mean, the woodpecker's the king of the jungle down here, you know, but after them, the nuthatches are a close second. Yeah. Nothing else really comes in and messes when the nuthatches on the feeder. They're really interesting to see how they've kind of found their place in the food chain already, you know.
There it is, coming across the ground.
Good spot. So we'll see if this one hangs about.
Again, it seems to use that log lying in the ground almost as a little highway.
Yeah, we quite that used to actually sit right on top of the fence there, and they used to come across and jump over it. But yeah, it was well rotten by then. I think usually they'll take the easiest way through possible.
Isn't that an absolute delight? There's a sawn-off stump in the ground, so it's maybe sitting about 2.5 feet high. There it is. It goes up to the top of the stump, leaps onto the next tree, jumps back down onto the stump. And that's it actually going into the feed. I don't know whether you heard the top going down there again. This guy's a star. But it's like watching on the ground. It's like watching a fox or a dog in long grass, you know, when they do that kind of leap up to see what's underneath them.
They're fascinating, aren't they? I mean, they never stop. Yeah. That's it going into the box on the back here now, the one hidden behind the stump.
As the squirrel disappeared behind the stump, a robin appeared from underneath the stump, the other side. So whether it's got flushed out by the squirrel, I don't know.
What I love about the squirrels is that they just don't stop. They're always on the move. I would have dreamt of seeing this as a kid, and now, you know, you get to see it any time you want to. It's...
You shouldn't say you can see it any time you want to. That's you contractually obligated. he said on Radio Scotland. There it is, up in the stump again. I never even saw it crossing the ground. It's just balancing the stump. The tail folded across its head, and it's eating a nut. And the thing is, shave that thing's tail. You're talking about a rat.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? One of the things I think about the squirrels, we had someone down doing a talk recently who said, you know, what people relate to with them is just that they're so human. You've got this little kind of alien thing that, yeah, is basically a rat with a nice tail and some ear tufts, but they do these really human things, and, you know, they nibble away on the nuts, they climb the trees and scold you if you get too close to them and things like that. You know, there's so much character.
Just while we've been sitting here waiting for the next squirrel to turn up, I looked round and there's, you know, standing in the sunlight in this glade is Bambi, just eating away at the leaves on that fallen tree. And that will not go down well with the squirrels.
Yep, that's the squirrel's favourite hiding place. I can imagine that deer is going to be getting the scolding soon.
Tom Bowser and the squirrels at Agati near Doon.
You hear stories about squirrels chucking nuts at things. I've never seen it.
Throwing nuts at things?
Yeah, to get them. You know,
no, they're not going to throw away food.
Yeah, no, if there's a whole pile of food, they'll chuck nuts at things.
Uh-huh.
But I've no knowledge of that. No. What I did see, we were doing a programme, Winter Watch, up at near Bewley.
Aegis Field Centre.
Sorry about that. And there was a squirrel.
Uh-huh.
And he was stashing nuts.
Uh-huh.
And up on the branches was a jay. And every time the squirrel went away, the jay came down and got the nuts. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, this blur of bright red fur comes screaming out the undergrowth and missed the jay by inches. And the jay just hopped 10 feet.
Uh-huh.
And then the squirrel got a massive leap and just missed it again. It was fascinating.
Squirrel fights Jay. That is it for this edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm afraid if you enjoy our podcast and you've got a couple of seconds, give us a rating or a review.
Yeah, not... Tell other people about it as well.
Well, exactly. It's not an ego trip for us. It just apparently helps other people find us. Look out for our midweek podcast too, which this coming week is actually going to be a picnic that we took at Colliston, which turned into World War III. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.